Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and today we are here. We are at the Paul Foote Awards, the most exciting day in the investigative journalism calendar. We're at a huge crowded party with the nominees, journalists from everywhere. No, sorry. We're actually, of course, at home, just like you are and just like everyone else has been for a very long time. However, the Paul Foote Awards are still happening, and there is a shortlist full of the most amazing, interesting, brilliant stories by some of the most dogged and determined journalists out there. We'll be hearing from all the shortlisted journalists with an amazing array of stories covering subjects from corruption to, actually it is mostly corruption in all sorts of places, but there are many different kinds of corruption. But before we get into all that, here is Ian Hislop, the magazine's editor. I started off by asking him how excited he was about a virtual Paul Foote Awards.
Yeah, we've suddenly moved into a different world, but it is very worthwhile just in a different way. I mean, there's obviously less alcohol and hacks falling over. And more concentration on the stories.
So regular listeners to the podcast will have known before that we do this, but just for anyone who's new, can you tell us a bit about the awards, their purpose, and of course, about Paul Foote?
Yes, when Paul Foote, who was a sort of great campaigning journalist and mainstay of the Eye in two batches, one in the early days of the 60s, and then he left, and then when I became editor, almost the first and certainly the best decision I made was to rehire him. And covered an extraordinary range of miscarriage of justice, and campaigning, journalistic stories. I mean, just an incredible range. When he died, we wanted to set up some award to remember him. And essentially, it was there to reflect whatever the state of journalism was. And we were never entirely sure whether that would be positive or not.
And you mentioned the stories just there, so we'll get on to the stories, the interviews with the shortlistees in a bit. But what a crop this year. You must be very pleased by the stories that you've got in.
Yes, they were great. And they were a fantastic reminder because there's only been one story in all of our memories now. And 2020 is going to go down as that was it. It's sort of virus or nothing. It was just a great reminder that there are other things happening that are important, will be important again, and that can't just disappear. I mean, lots of people have cancelled awards this year. I mean, the Turner Prize has been cancelled, which, I mean, you either find that very distressing or not, but, you know, some people just gave up. And we thought we shouldn't. We should absolutely run them.
Is there something in particular that you think marks an especially good Paul Foote Awards story or campaign?
Yes, I think it is. They're not for a scoop. They're not really for a one-off, we found this out and then that was it. It's more for that sort of badgering quality of finding out there's something wrong, running a couple of pieces about it, more work about it. It tends to be for more of an effort, really, more of a longer-term thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with scoops. It's fantastic. People who cultivate their sources and get them is great, but it's just, for a Foote Award, that quality of just badgering away. And again, I mean, when brilliant editor though I am, I would often say, oh God, have I got to run this? Is this another piece about that? And he would say, yeah, you do have to run it. And it is that quality of just refusing to give up, really.
Ian Hislop there. I also managed to catch up with the chief of this year's judges, Padraig Reedy. So, Padraig, nice to see you. Sorry it's not an actual party. How have you found the judging experience this year from your isolation chamber?
Yeah, this is very sad, isn't it? Normally you're running around BAFTA and cornering me just as I'm deep in conversation and forcing me to think on my feet at a party, which is never a good idea. And what was very pleasing for us was that there was, again, the exact same, you know, pretty much the exact same number of applications that we get every year from very different people.
Well, the range of entries is so broad this year. You've got, you know, huge, great international stories like the Bloomberg submission. You've got local papers. You've got everything in between. You've got websites. You've got traditional print. It's such a varied list, as we're going to hear in a bit.
It is. It's really encouraging to see the range. But everyone from Bloomberg Businessweek, this global behemoth of capital, to the Yellow Advertiser, which is a local newspaper in Basildon and surrounding areas, it's just really wonderful. It just showed that, you know, the quality of the work is the thing that draws them all together rather than the subject matter. The subject matter and the outlets were very different. I think always the highlight for me is when I look at a story when I'm reading one of the entries, I think, I never even thought of that as an issue, but suddenly this has blown the whole thing open. And there are so many stories here that, you know, in the short list and even in the long list that you thought, I had no idea this happened.
There have been some of the reporters who changed jobs, the Basildon paper, that shut down halfway through.
Yes.
The investigation. and Charles Thompson, who is the nominee, he had to got a job elsewhere and he kept reporting the same story for his new employers.
Charles has you know, wonderfully, he has got a new job. I think the Yellow Advertiser has relaunched in a format, which is very pleasing. Obviously, you know, the media's facing an incredibly difficult time, as was witnessed, you know, by the Yellow Advertiser, a great local paper with a local tradition, shutting down. I think every single outlet here, pretty much on the shortlist, has been in some way affected by the, you know, the terrifying times facing media, and will be affected, you know, more again by the pandemic. But again, that just goes to show that people are still dedicated to doing this work, and that it still pays to do this work in terms of recognition, but also in terms of these are big stories that got, you know, that get read by their audience and get respected by their audience.
Padraig Reedy. So, let's get into the actual stories themselves. We managed to spend a bit of time with each of the shortlisted journalists for this year's awards. First up is Kit Chalel from Bloomberg News.
The story is headlined, "Is One of the World's Biggest Lawsuits Built on a Sham?" And it's about this extremely large legal dispute that's currently being heard in a London courtroom for roughly $10 billion between Nigeria and a basically unknown engineering company called Process and Industrial Developments.
Process and Industrial Developments. Who are these people?
The guys behind P&ID were these two Irishmen, one of whom was a former mechanic and music manager. So his name is Mick Quinn. I spent nearly 10 years working as a court reporter down at the Royal Courts of Justice in London, covering big commercial disputes, criminal cases. And I'd been hearing for years about this idea of sham litigation, an elaborate money laundering ruse whereby you manufacture a lawsuit with someone you know for the purposes of settling it. That money goes through a court or law firm bank account and it comes out the other side completely clean. A very neat idea, and I kept hearing about it to the point where I knew that senior law firm partners were getting training about how to spot these kinds of fake cases, but I'd never seen one. And so I just, everyone I met in the course of my work and the sources I speak to, I would just ask about it. And finally, I met someone who said, you should look at this case. It's very weird. It's $9 billion, and it's this little firm that doesn't have a website or any employees or any track record. And so I started looking into it for the purpose of discovering, you know, who was behind the firm, how did they get this huge concession? And the more I looked, the weirder and weirder it got.
So this is the Nigerian government being pressured to hand over nearly $10 billion to this firm.
Yeah. So at the moment I became aware of the story, an arbitration had already happened in London and P&ID had won. So despite the fact that P&ID had never built anything, they had never, you know, put a shovel in the ground in Nigeria, they had won a $9 or $10 billion award from an arbitration panel in London because the Nigerian government breached its obligations under the contract. So they never got to build the gas plant, but the court worked out that their profits, had they built it, would have been worth $9 or $10 billion.
And so, so there was a contract in place which the Nigerian government was supposedly in breach of.
Exactly.
Okay, to build a gas plant in Nigeria.
So P&ID had a contract. The plan was to build this big gas flaring plant that would have supplied electricity for a decade or more. It all fell to pieces for reasons that are kind of murky and unclear and probably irrelevant. But because P&ID had this contract, they were able to come to through the international legal system, through international arbitration, and sue Nigeria and win. And the sum of money they won was just mind-blowing. I mean, for a small company with no employees to win nearly $10 billion from a sovereign state is very, very rare. So they already had their victory, and they were then coming through the London court system to try and enforce it and get their money. And at this point, there really wasn't any question about whether the deal was legit or not. So it took me about a year of investigation, you know, going through the entire history of this company and its founders to reach the conclusion that actually, yes, this wasn't what it appeared to be.
So if this is money laundering, this is dirty money within the Nigerian government that is being cleaned on its way out. Is that correct?
It's actually very clever. If what is alleged to be the case is true, it is both theft and money laundering in one go. So the reason that this type of scheme is so ingenious is because it allows you to siphon millions and millions of dollars from the Nigerian state in one fell swoop and clean it at the same time. Because the money isn't just being passed back and forth in bribes, the money passes through the international legal system. So you have your contract from the Nigerian government. It's an illicit contract. It's a fraud. The contract is breached. You sue. You go to a court of arbitration in London or Brussels, wherever it may be. The judges agree with you because you have a contract. And then Nigeria is forced to pay you $50, $100, $150 million. That money goes through the legal system. And it comes out, not only is it clean, no one can touch it, it's tax-free, and it's also impossible to seize under proceeds of crime laws. So the money is yours. You've pulled off an amazing scam if you're able to do this. It's very clever.
The amazing thing is how many people cropped up in support of P&ID, this company which had, as you say, no employees, no website, no assets.
When they won their case at the London Court of International Arbitration, which has a very grand name and it deals with international disputes for billions of dollars, it had two retired High Court judges sitting on the panel. These were serious jurists. You know, these were among the most important members of the international legal profession. And they ruled in favour of P&ID, seemingly without ever questioning how this company had won the contract in the first place. So that's number one. Once P&ID had its victory at the London Court of International Arbitration, it sought alliances to try and get the Nigerians to pay. And it teamed up with this big hedge fund called VR Capital, again, which is a legitimate business enterprise. It's a distressed debt specialist, but it has offices in Paris and London. It manages billions of dollars in assets. And they signed into a partnership with P&ID. Then once that happened, they used this Washington-based lobbying firm who were putting out sort of materials in the press praising P&ID and attacking the Nigerian government for not paying its debt. Again, it's not clear how many of these parties who found themselves on the side of P&ID had any awareness of what they were dealing with. They just seemed to sign up and take their fees and do as they were told. And then finally, we had Priti Patel, who I think at the time was the Secretary for International Development. And she wrote this remarkable piece in City AM, the London newspaper, excoriating the Nigerian government for failing to meet its contractual obligations. And she specifically mentioned the process and industrial development case.
So the story came out. What happened next?
The cynical part of me thought, oh, this is another big Nigerian government fraud. You know, there are lots of them, unfortunately, and people wouldn't care. But something about this one really inflamed passions in Nigeria. There was a huge response to it. It was all over the local press. A radio show did a two-hour segment just on P&ID. People were angry and upset and kind of depressed that this had happened, that this had gone on in their country, and you know, seemingly it had taken an outside news organization to expose what was going on. I believe at one point there was even a protest outside the Irish embassy in Abuja. So it got pretty serious in Nigeria, and that placed pressure on the Nigerian government to do something. So the Buhari administration promised to increase its investigation into the P&ID contract. It set the government anti-fraud agency, the EFCC, on the case, and they started arresting people, including former employees of P&ID, government officials, a couple of Irish associates who worked with Mick Quinn were arrested and put in prison. And there was an international arrest warrant put out for Michael Quinn's son in Ireland. So there's been a big response, and the investigators have found some very interesting evidence about the nature of P&ID and how it ran its business. You know, they have witness statements now from government officials who are saying that P&ID representatives would take them out for dinner and then give them a black bin bag full of cash after dinner and say, we want to be your friends. So the business model is starting to emerge. And the latest development is that they're finally fighting the fraud case. They're finally saying in courts to a London judge, this contract was a scam that was designed to fail and we are not going to pay. And so later this year, there's going to be a case in London and they're going to make that argument. And the interesting thing will be to see whether they have sufficient evidence to convince a British judge that it was a fraud to begin with.
I, for one, cannot wait to see how that develops. What a fabulous story, and congratulations on your nomination.
Thank you so much. It's a real honour.
So I'm Alexandra Heal. I'm a reporter at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism.
So, Alexandra, congratulations on your nomination. Can you tell us a bit about the story that's got you here?
So it's a series of stories about domestic abuse by police officers and forces not taking it seriously. So either not investigating it at all or doing a really shoddy job when they do investigate it, or even other officers becoming involved in harassing the domestic abuse victim. The story is mainly about bad forces rather than bad officers, but I also did come across lots of cases of perpetrators really abusing their role in the police to intimidate their wives or partners, you know, saying, "I'll get you thrown in prison if you report it. I know the legal system better than you, and my colleagues will protect me." And in some cases, those threats did turn out to be true. One woman who found the courage to report the abuse later found out the officer assigned to investigate it was on the same football team as her husband, which is just a prime example. But yeah, so I'd say overall, the story is really just about how reporting and getting justice for domestic abuse is so difficult when your abuser works for the very organisation that is supposed to protect you.
The really extraordinary thing from reading about your work on this is that there aren't very strict rules in place already that when someone makes a complaint about domestic abuse by someone who might be a member of the police force, that that complaint is not automatically investigated by a different enough part of the organisation to have a bit of an objective view upon it.
I know, and that was one of the most shocking things. I did lots of freedom of information requests to gather data for the story, and it turned out that less than one in three forces have any sort of specific procedures in place in their policies to deal with, you know, domestic abuse by police employees. And it was only three forces in a tri-force policy. So Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire and Cambridgeshire said that they would refer only in certain cases, mind, but said they would refer it to another external force to investigate it.
How did you find people willing to go on the record? This is obviously an incredibly sensitive matter for anyone who's been a victim of this kind of domestic abuse, and it must be very difficult to persuade people to talk about their experiences.
Yes, well, in order to find the people, I had to phone over 150 domestic abuse services and charities around the country. So I found quite a lot of women that way. But what was actually really interesting is that none of them needed persuading. All of them were actually desperate to talk about their experiences. And I think it's a result of feeling like they'd had no justice through the formal routes and just feeling like they'd been silenced and really wanting to talk about it. And in pretty much every case, it was because they didn't want another woman or man, but, you know, another victim to go through what they'd been through.
And the other interesting thing, actually, is how widely this story has been published in lots of different outlets, because you work for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, but it's been published in lots of places, all kind of leading back to your reporting.
Yeah, which is really exciting. And I think that's part of the reason it's had such a good impact. The most exciting thing that's happened since the story was published was that the Centre for Women's Justice has submitted a super complaint against the police nationwide about this issue.
Now, is a super complaint, just quickly?
I knew you were going to ask. So a super complaint is a new mechanism launched a couple of years ago to allow certain designated organisations to complain about widespread issues in policing that apply to forces across the country, not just one force.
And you were saying that the Centre for Women's Justice has been able to issue one of these super complaints?
Yes. So basically, so they had this idea of launching a super complaint. They talked about it the day after we published the first story. And so I shared all my data with them, and the women who wanted to speak to them, I passed over to them. And they spent a fair few months drawing up the super complaint and thinking about the kinds of recommendations they wanted to make for the police regulators to look into and advise the police forces to implement. And yeah, so they submitted that in March, and already it's having quite a good effect. So the police regulators haven't even done their investigation into it yet, but already two forces are working with a charity to pilot new training based on the super complaint. And a couple of other police leaders have told the Centre for Women's Justice that they are kind of looking at what they can do within their own forces or force areas to get ahead of the curve. And hopefully when the police regulators eventually finish their investigation, they'll have official recommendations.
It must be extremely gratifying to see concrete results from your research, as you say, even before the official processes have finished, because as we know, these things can take such a long time, and so many stories can take such a long time and still not yield results.
Yeah, exactly. It's just really nice, and it's nice because all of the women, or a lot of the women that I worked with on this story, have all said that they're really pleased that that's happened. And I think that's the most important thing, is just trying to, you know, make sure this, again, as I said earlier, that this doesn't happen to other women, because it just, from speaking to him, it just sounds like the most horrific thing to go through.
It's a fascinating and brilliantly researched story. You know, 150 charities to get in contact with. So many congratulations on your nomination.
Thank you very much.
I'm Katie J.M. Baker, and I'm an investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News.
And I'm Tom Warren. I'm an investigations correspondent at BuzzFeed News. In essence, it's a story about the conservation group WWF, not the wrestling group, I should add. We've had a lot of tweets about that. Yeah, but the Worldwide Fund for Nature. Now, they are involved in supporting anti-wildlife crime enforcement activities around the world, and this has resulted in a swathe of human rights abuses across Africa, across Asia. People have been tortured, raped, murdered by the forces that are supported by this charity.
That is extraordinary. I mean, people have a very, I think, positive worldview of the WWF. Katie, what first set you guys onto this story? What made you think something might be amiss?
Well, it started with a single thread in Cameroon. There's a nonprofit with contacts there that had been saying for years that guards were tied to WWF, who were committing these violations against indigenous villagers. But the allegations were a little vague. There were no records behind them. This was thousands of miles away, so nobody could really prove it. So Tom and I set out to get those documents, to find the medical records and the legal records, which of course is very difficult when you're dealing with these indigenous communities who often don't have that type of access. And finally, we also worked really hard to gain the trust of people in Nepal and India and Cameroon so that they would feel comfortable sharing these stories with us.
What was the picture that emerged of WWF's activities?
It was quite wide-ranging. I mean, in essence, it's kind of a compliance story. It's about, you know, where was the blind spot in an organisation and what went wrong. So WWF was involved funding these various enforcement efforts. So there was engagement there. But also they were engaged on a policy and operational level. So they'd help design the enforcement systems in parks. And on occasion, they would become involved with some kinds of enforcement activities. So they'd email, you know, we managed to get emails where we had a WWF manager discussing rangers purchasing weapons, which is against the rules for charities, but also getting involved in operations, liaising with the army about sending in troops to find poachers. And then obviously there was an impact from this that when things did go wrong, WWF didn't properly investigate. So we heard about a family that complained to the charity. They had a young son. He was in his early teens. He was a really young man, you know, between 10 and 14 years old. And he'd been tortured with his parents, with his mum and dad, and he'd been tortured in front of them. They complained to the charity. The charity never went to visit him to hear about his story. They never really followed up on these allegations of abuses. So what we did is went out and found some of these victims to tell their stories.
This must have been, as you touched on earlier, unbelievably tricky to research and report on from thousands of miles away. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one breakthrough moment we had was when we heard that there had been a court case in Nepal where park rangers had been accused of torturing a man to death, and that, you know, we heard there was a cover-up, and we were able to, still being here, get those legal documents, translate them from Nepali, and just the logistical hurdles, you know, getting sources to trust us enough to entrust us with those documents. All that was very difficult, but it was worth it once we got those documents, because in 90 pages or so, they just laid out, with autopsy reports, testimony from witnesses, everything, what exactly had happened. And then once we had a roadmap from that, where we could go and report out what had happened. And it turned out that the men who had been accused not only got off, but were being supported by WWF. One of them had gotten an award from WWF. And my favorite aspect, one of them had actually written a memoir in which he had admitted to waterboarding some of these poaching suspects.
I mean, that's not exactly trying to cover your tracks.
It was amazing to see a charity go out and actually advocate for law enforcement officers that had killed an innocent civilian to be freed. It was, it was kind of a real shock. And in terms of the reporting as well, we did obviously travel outside the UK. Katie went to India and Nepal. We also went to Cameroon as well, and the Congo Basin. And then obviously there were a lot of people who had worked, I mean, we can't discuss this too much, but there were a lot of people who had worked in the charity sector who had returned to the developed world, who had these stories, and they would be like, well, I saw this happen or that happen. So it really was a kind of global effort, which made it a really fascinating one to report out.
The stories are so geographically spread because it's a global charity, obviously. One really interesting aspect is the way in which all of these separate examples of criminal behaviour seem to be linked together by an overall pattern of trying to conceal them. What did you guys find out about, as it were, how far up the organisation these things were known about?
We suspected that the executives at the top of WWF knew all this was happening, but it took us a lot of reporting to prove it. Ultimately, we did get secret confidential documents that it showed that they had been reviewed by the CEO and executive director, that said years ago they knew that they had hired their own investigators to go travel to some of these places. The investigators came back and said WWF urgently needs to take action. These abuses are happening. There is tons of evidence, and they didn't do anything. And so, you know, getting those documents months after our initial reporting, which WWF had responded to basically by saying these are very specific instances, we're going to take action. We didn't know about this. If it's actually true, you know, we'll do something. Really put that response into context, seeing that they had known about this for years.
Yeah, and I mean that run a really strong, they had huge PR and fundraising campaigns based on rangers. They didn't ever really want to discuss the fact that the rangers they were supporting were doing things that were wrong. And when we initially went and met with them, it was very much, oh well, we don't work with the rangers like that. We're not that close. And I think now we've been reporting it. It was 2017, wasn't it, that we were working on this? So it's been kind of years of work, you know, to kind of get to where we are. I haven't muddled my dates, have I, Kate?
It's what is time anymore. Yeah. It was a long investigation, but it really, with stories like this, it's working on long-term investigations is hard because you don't know whether you're going to get enough evidence for the story to be worth it, you know, to be able to tell your editors, you know, thanks for letting me travel all over the world and spend time trying to translate Nepali documents.
The story's had a huge impact. There's been an inquiry launched by the Charity Commission. WWF is conducting a review, and you've noticed that its response to new allegations of abuse has changed dramatically in that time.
Yeah, U.S. lawmakers launched a bipartisan investigation and ultimately introduced legislation a few months ago to deter fewer taxpayer-funded instances of torture, rape, and extrajudicial killings, basically making sure that funding's not going towards law enforcement in these cases without any oversight. And government agencies in the UK and Germany, like you said, are conducting their own probes in the Government Accountability Office. And WWF is still conducting its own investigation led by a former UN Human Rights Commissioner. It's been over a year since our reporting, and we still haven't seen the results of that. But the charity has already introduced sweeping reforms, which is great to see.
I studied social anthropology at university, and I first got told about this by one of my lecturers, who said the greatest threat to Indigenous people in the Congo Basin, it's not loggers, it's not miners, it's conservationists. And it stuck with me for years. And you know, the crazy thing about this story is people knew for decades. They knew for decades that this was going on. And it's amazing. It's just when things are outside the West, outside of Europe, outside the US, it's really easy to just kind of ignore them. Because of that, this has been like the most gratifying project I've ever worked on. People knew for years, but nobody acted on it.
It's a fabulous story, and congratulations again on your nomination.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Katie Baker and Tom Warren from BuzzFeed there. Next up is Frances Ryan of The Guardian. Here she is.
I started writing about Britain's disability curse in around 2013, so almost a decade ago. That was around the time that the first wave of curse came into force. So things like the bedroom tax and the abolition of disability living allowance, which pays for the extra costs of disability. At that time, it wasn't really being talked about in the mainstream press, and I thought it was incredibly important to do so. I think disability generally is a really unrepresented group. There's very few journalists with disabilities. Disabled people's voices aren't really heard. And when they are heard, particularly around that time, 2013, it was in a really negative way. The whole scrounger rhetoric was incredibly strong, both in parts of the press and from the government itself. I thought it was really important to get sort of a fairer, if you like, more accurate picture out there. I think another part of it was simply that it seemed so obviously unjust what was happening. These were people who were already, you know, dealing with physical or mental health problems, who were just about holding on financially due to having various bits of support from the state. The safety net was helping these people survive. And then this wave of austerity came in that was disproportionately weighted towards pulling support from disabled people. And the impact of that was really quickly devastating. You know, these people who suddenly couldn't afford to eat regular meals, who couldn't get out of the house anymore. It seemed so incredibly cruel and unjust. It was the most incredibly strong symbol, I think, of just what happens when a safety net for a country is decimated. The people who rely on it the most are the ones that actually lose it first. One of the stories that was part of their campaign was the Take or Leave It offer story from the Department for Work and Pensions, which essentially was where we found that the DWP was cold calling disabled people who had been previously rejected for their social security and were going to the formal appeal process, but the DWP called them up to offer them a lower award than they would have won if they had followed through to tribunal. And in many cases, these were off the record calls. I think most disturbingly, they were being made to particularly vulnerable people, so people with early onset Alzheimer's, for example, or severe mental health problems. And these people were being somewhat urged to take this offer that was often thousands of pounds less than they would have been legally entitled to if they'd gone to appeal. Another story was my investigation into disabled women using sex work to survive benefit cuts. So for about 6 months to a year, I started to try and find women who had been affected by this issue. What we saw was disabled women who had been rejected for out-of-work disability benefits but were still too disabled to go into traditional 9-to-5 employment. So they found themselves very much in a catch-22 without a safety net and were using sex work as really their only option in order to survive. I went about uncovering the stories in a few different ways. Sometimes in issues occurring that's affecting the general population. And I wondered whether or not it was affecting disabled people too. So, for example, we saw reports that marginalised women were being forced into sex work as a result of benefit cuts, but there were no reports on what was happening to disabled women. So that, for example, led me to investigate that issue. Secondly, I think tip-offs and sort of readers contacting me is a huge part of the work. I get a huge amount of support from disabled people who have already sort of been aware of the campaign in its early years and who therefore contact me about something that's happening in their life. And also grassroots charities and organisations are often, you know, the first people to know that an issue is starting to affect people on the ground, and they're sort of good enough to contact me to let me know what's happening and we can investigate from there. It was sometimes difficult to get people to go on the record when we're talking about people who have been treated badly by authority, who have trusted the government, for example, and then have been treated in a way that's actively harmed them. Understandably, there's reluctance to trust other people. People saw the campaign developing, I think, and they trusted what we were putting out, and that helped them trust me. I think what's quite unique about this campaign is that it's such a long-term one. It's been running really for about the best part of a decade. And though it started off looking at the original austerity measures, what we've seen is, of course, that they've just kept on coming. So at the start, I don't think I did expect this to go on for so long. But that's really, I think, symbolic of the wider issue. Disability cuts are so powerful because they don't just come in singular. They are sort of coming from all the different parts of the social safety net. So we're seeing things like social care cuts, disability benefits, housing, council tax, domestic violence refuges. There are so many different parts of the safety net that disabled people can rely on. So whilst we started off seeing the bedroom tax as an initial policy, what we've seen as the campaign has gone on, that these policies have just not only stayed in place, but others have come along to join them. The campaign has had some great achievements along the way. Firstly, we've had the stories picked up many times by different broadcast media, which is great because it means that we reach another audience and it pushes these stories onto the mainstream agenda. We've actually seen a huge amount of money raised in response to these stories, which is in no way the point, but you know, I think over the last 10 years we've had about 100 grand sort of spontaneously donated from readers. And thirdly, and I think most importantly, it's when we see tangible change for the people who are featured in the stories. So for example, when I've reported on social care cuts, we've seen the local authority in response to the stories increase someone's care package. Or I know a young person who was having to live in a residential care for the elderly into a home more suitable for them. And those sort of things are, you know, always the achievements that make me the happiest, because they are, you know, it's real change in a way that genuinely transforms a disabled person's life.
Frances Ryan there. We've got two more of the shortlist to go before we announce the winner. Next up is Charles Thompson of the Yellow Advertiser.
So I was working at the Yellow Advertiser, which was an Essex newspaper series, and this investigation concerned a historic paedophile ring which ran from Southend, Shoebury-Ness, in the late 1980s. And the investigation centred really on why the police failed to act on a huge amount of intelligence and evidence that they were given by local child protection workers. I've been looking into that since 2015, and in the stories that were submitted for the Paul Foot Award, we revealed that the leader of that paedophile ring was actually working as a police informant at the time. You know, when you think of the concept of a police informant and the way we all understand it from what we see in TV shows, cop dramas and that kind of thing, is typically they're using a small fry dealer or a fence to get to the bigger fish, to climb up the chain and get the people that really are at the head of what's going on. But when you're looking at somebody who is a serially convicted and very dangerous child molester, who could they possibly be informing on that's more important than what they're doing?
Yeah.
And when we were working with child abuse charities, they were saying that almost any advantage you could confer on that informant, whether it be turning a blind eye to what they're doing, getting them a reduced sentence or whatever, that you're almost certainly aiding their crimes against children by doing that.
And how did this story first come to your attention? Because, as you said, this is a case that was first worked on in 1989. It's a long time ago now.
Yeah, so what happened was, it was right in the middle of the Jimmy Savile fallout, and I had uncovered a series of payments that Essex Council had made out of court for alleged child abuse, stretching back to the 70s. And I wrote some stories about those payments and about Essex Council's refusal to answer any questions about them.
Yeah, so and, what is this? Is this members of the council who are settling out of court to settle these claims?
We still don't know. We know that they were paying these payments, but they refused to answer any questions. That, you know, all these years later, we have no idea what those payments were for. But when we reported on them, a guy who used to work for the council as a consultant, whose name was Robin Jameson, he used to be the district psychologist for Southend, read the stories and just came into the office unannounced and said, if you're investigating historic abuse, then I've got something you really need to look into. And that was how I got sent off on the tangent of looking into the Shoebury case.
Okay, and what did you find along the way?
Oh, boy. Well, we now have a huge number of sources that are cooperating with us, from health workers to social workers, charity workers, victims, lawyers. And along the way, we've uncovered huge amounts of paperwork. All of the official paperwork is missing or destroyed. But thankfully, a lot of our whistleblowers had the foresight to keep their paperwork. So we have access to huge amounts of intelligence from the original investigation. And we've also uncovered some new information. So we discovered a link between the Shoebury gang and the Dirty Dozen gang that were involved in the Jason Swift killing. And we discovered also Dennis King, the ringleader's status as a police informant.
Well, you've just mentioned that a lot of the paperwork was destroyed. This must have been enormously embarrassing as a story for both Essex Police and Essex Council. And I think you mentioned that there was quite a lot of resistance to the questions you were asking along the way.
Particularly Essex Council. I mean, some of the paperwork we were looking for we still haven't got, and they just came up with every excuse in the book. They had a report commissioned in the late 90s, and that work continued into the early 2000s, where they had an independent consultant who was investigating historic allegations and Essex Council's failure to deal properly with child abuse. Mm. That report, we tried over and over again to get them to disclose that report. And in the end, they claimed that if they were forced to disclose this report, it would force them to stop investigating allegations against their staff going forward, which is one of the most bizarre things I've ever heard. They said if we're forced to disclose this report, it will discourage us from having similar investigations in future.
Yeah, and it's an interesting argument.
yeah, it's novel. I've not heard that one before.
Yeah. There will be victims of some of this abuse who are still out there and still, you know, living with the memories of this. Have you been in contact with any of the victims themselves?
Yes, several of them. Unfortunately, a number are either dead from suicides or drug overdoses. One of them is detained indefinitely in a psychiatric hospital. Some of them are homeless, very difficult to find. You know, these people's lives were destroyed. But we did manage to get in contact with some of them. And one of them is working with us very closely, formed the basis of one of the stories that's included in the Paulfoot submission. And he's now going through a huge IOPC complaint. The Independent Office of police conduct.
One thing that sometimes crops up with this kind of case is the difficulty of conducting research into a story at this huge distance of time. Did you find anything like that?
Well, there were two main problems. The first one was the amount of people who are now dead. And the other problem was that a lot of public bodies have destroyed their paperwork from that era. So Essex Council told us that all of their paper records from that case have been destroyed. The court records, some of them have been destroyed, some of them are missing. Essex Council, huge amounts of paperwork either destroyed or missing. So that was a problem. Fortunately, it was a gap that our whistleblowers were able to fill because a lot of them had kept copies of their paperwork from the original case. But there is information which is just completely lost, unfortunately, and we won't ever find it, I don't think. Like the court records, that they're just vanished.
And there's one other personal element I wanted to ask about this story, which is that while you were in the middle of breaking these stories, publishing these scoops and winning awards for them, you were told that your job at the Yellow Advertiser no longer existed.
Yeah, that's it was an incredible sequence of events, really. So I came into work on a Monday and somebody from head office came in and told us the paper's not making enough money and this week's paper will be the last you ever print. So that was on the Wednesday. The paper came out on the Wednesday, the South End paper. So the South End deadline for the final Yellow Advertiser was on the Tuesday. With hours to go before the final paper, I won this huge battle I'd been having with the Ministry of Justice to get hold of Dennis King's criminal record, literally about midday, and the deadline was that evening for the final paper. So we had to scrap the front page we were planning, write a whole new story. We ended up working, you know, hours and hours of overtime that night to just get the paper put together. So it was kind of fortuitous in a way. You know, you couldn't make that up. It was such an amazing coincidence. So we won this huge war we'd been having with the MOJ with hours to spare before the final paper went to the printers.
It basically allowed it to go out on another scoop, is what you're saying.
Yeah. We went out with almost like the final installment of that section of the investigation. But what we're doing now at Archon is we're turning it into a podcast series. So we're taking the investigation I've already done and turning it into a documentary series that's going to come out under Archon's. They run a cold case podcast series called Unfinished. It's published by the Eastern Daily Press. And we're turning Shoebury into a documentary series. So I'm right in the middle of writing that at the moment. And people will be able to hear some of my original interviews right back to 2015. And some new ones, and we'll just tell the story of how it all unfolded.
And if you'd like to hear more of this story from Charles and from his colleagues at the Eastern Daily Press, you can subscribe to the podcast Unfinished on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. Charles, thank you so much for talking to us, and congratulations again on your nomination.
Thanks very much.
My name is Nadine White, and I'm a news reporter at HuffPost UK.
My name's Emma Yule, and I'm special correspondent at HuffPost UK.
This is an investigation into a church called SPAC Nation, which for a long time had been praised by politicians and the media as a pioneering solution to the knife crime epidemic. But we uncovered very serious allegations of various types of alleged abuses that were taking place in the church, and dedicated months to investigating the topic, which has led to a police investigation and also a charity commission investigation into the organisation.
Can you tell us a bit more about these alleged abuses that may have been going on at the church?
Yeah, so the church, as part of its outreach work, runs a number of or used to run a number of safe houses, which they refer to as trap houses, where, you know, hard to reach young people, vulnerable young people would stay. And there were allegations, multiple allegations of safeguarding abuses on various levels, ranging from physical abuse and violence to sexual. So that had been raised by a few sources that we spoke to, and also financial exploitation taking place within the church itself. By way of coercion or concerns around coercion to come up with large sums of money to give to the church to fund lifestyles of pastors within the church.
That's a really interesting element, because I think stories of churches asking people for their own savings have been heard before, but I'd never heard of this before, where the church was asking people to take out loans in order to fund the pastor's lifestyle.
Yes, taking out loans, ruining their credit scores. In some cases, one particular case, Toye Mary was a former member of SPAC Nation Church. She began attending the church after, you know, experiencing a particularly rough time at her former church, so she was seeking a new spiritual home. Began attending SPAC Nation, was befriended by a pastor who said that he could help her, you know, to get on her feet financially. At this time, she was unemployed and struggling, and he ended up taking out a few loans in her name behind her back. And she found out, was understandably very upset. So there have been similar instances raised in the past of things like that happening.
There was this concept of seed that Nadine started hearing about really early on when she was talking to young people that had been in the church. And it was this idea that you would give seed or offering money to the church as part of the weekly services. But the congregation that SPAC Nation was targeting was mainly, you know, young Black people from impoverished areas. So there wasn't maybe spare money available to be able to donate to a church in the way that it might be if it was sort of older and people with more established jobs. So that was sort of part of the root of why there was times pastors were allegedly pressurising these young people to take loans, because it gave them access to, at times, up to sort of £5,000 that otherwise they just wouldn't have had. The other thing that we had some examples of was people giving their entire student loans as seed offering to SPAC Nation. So lots of really young people were being left with absolutely terrible credit ratings and in some cases as sort of guarantors on significant debt, which we just found really troubling.
Did you find it easy to look past that incredibly popular media-friendly reputation when you were starting to explore the details of this story? Or was there a kind of weird dissonance between the popular image and what you were uncovering?
There was definitely a dissonance, and I think the story almost being hidden in plain sight, because when you went onto Twitter, there were just loads and loads of allegations that Nadine and I found really quickly. But when you looked at the sort of press reporting around the church at the time, they were really lauded as the church that persuades gang members to leave knives at the altar. We were seeing the church referencing itself meeting, you know, cabinet ministers at Downing Street, meeting police chiefs at Scotland Yard. The PR image of the church was one that it had, you know, was doing great work and was being praised by senior politicians, police. So it didn't match up at all. And I think one of the things we thought about a lot was why the allegations that were being made hadn't been looked at more seriously.
Yeah, there's a school of thought among many people who feel that authorities were slow to act and properly investigate SPAC Nation for fear of being labelled as racist, because it is a predominantly Black church, you know, that appeared to be doing the world of good in terms of its, you know, community outreach work and pioneering programs.
Did you find it easy to get through to people who've been victims of these sharp practices by the church?
It wasn't easy at all to gain trust, because again, race and a historic mistrust in the media, it was very central to this investigation as far as being an obstacle to overcome. So there was a long process of trust building, you know, convincing sources to go on the record, convincing sources that, you know, Emma and I have good intentions and our intentions are to really uncover what's going on and get to the heart of the issue. A lot of young people who we spoke to, you know, who ended up coming on as sources, previously felt let down and were slow to, you know, trust us to actually, you know, tell the story.
And what's happened since you first published this story? Have there been repercussions for the church?
I think shortly after we published, the Charity Commission launched an official inquiry into the church Spat Nation. The police currently have an open criminal investigation into individuals linked with the church. As soon as a couple of weeks ago, a 24-year-old man was arrested and released, and those investigations continue. We await the outcome of both of those, so it's still watch this space, really.
Yeah, the sources have been extremely encouraged by the response from police and the Charity Commission by way of, you know, investigations being launched. There's a sense of relief, you know, that they told their story and people were able to understand their perspective and learn what their experiences are. A few sources that I've spoken to have felt, that they've done a duty and a service to others to perhaps, you know, deter people from attending the church and you know, or at least being more cautious moving forward about who they trust. There was a bit of backlash from some parts of the Black community following publication. You know, a few Spat Nation sympathisers kind of labelled me as a bit of an enemy of progress and somebody who's you know, who was willing to cast a Black organisation in a negative light. But overall, the response has been really, really quite positive.
It's a fabulous story, and congratulations to both of you on your shortlisting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's the 2020 shortlist, full of amazing journalists, many of whom are very young, which is both very cheering and obviously very annoying. And that's just to reassure everyone that this year the money is real. We're doing this remotely, obviously, but it's not virtual money. Everybody will get a cheque and the winner will get a larger one. So it's now time to announce who the winner is. And the winner of the Paul Foote 2020 Awards is... You thought I'd frozen there on Zoom, didn't you? But I hadn't. It was for dramatic effect. The winner is Alexandra Heal. So congratulations to Alexandra. And when I told her she'd won, this is what she had to say.
So, yeah, I'm absolutely gobsmacked to have won. I couldn't even believe I was shortlisted for the Paul Foote Award alongside so many brilliant other stories. And so when I got a call to say I'd won, I was absolutely astounded. I was in the middle of cooking an omelette and I cried. And I've been grinning like a Cheshire cat ever since. So thank you so much, Private Eye. I obviously admire the journalism you do, and you play such an important role in the British media and society. I also, from what I've read about Paul Foote, he was such a committed and brilliant journalist. So I really hope he would approve. The most important thing to say is this award is for the women who came forward to speak to me for the various stories and for the super complaint. A lot of them found it so hard to relive their experiences by telling them to me. And they all were doing it because they wanted not another woman to go through the same shocking thing that they had. So I really hope the super complaint does lead to material changes and help end the kind of outrageous boys club culture that we've seen. I absolutely could not have published this story without the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and my editors there, Rachel Oldroyd, Myrian Jones and Miriam Wells. I took the story to them when I started on a short contract, and I never, you know, we never thought that it would take another year to get it published, but they were so supportive throughout and taught me so much because they're so experienced. And also, I want to say thank you to Andrew Wosley, who's my colleague on my other hat at the Bureau, is being on the environment team. That's my other main passion, and he's my colleague on that team, and he was so understanding when I went off to work on this and still do. It was the publishing partners that really amplified the story. Fiona Hamilton and John Simpson at The Times, Anna Adams at the BBC, and Mark Townsend at The Observer. And it goes without saying that so much of the impact of this story is down to the Centre for Women's Justice, in particular Noga Ofer and Harriet Wistrich. Noga worked for months on the super complaint, and it was only submitted in March, and the fact that it already seems to be having some sort of impact is really, really uplifting and promising. I want to thank my journalism tutor, Heather Brooke, who guided me a lot on the initial research, the friend who gave me the tip off She knows who she is. I want to thank the Bureau again for developing my journalism skills so much. And also to my boyfriend and my family for supporting me through quite a lot of tears, but being so excited when it was eventually published. And I guess the final thing to say is it is so outrageous that police forces have been allowing their officers to get away with this for so long. And I really hope the Chief Constables call time on it.
So congratulations to Alexandra and to the whole rest of the shortlist for their brilliant stories this year. As ever, the real winner was investigative journalism, although it was also Alexandra. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again next month with another one, and a year from now with a hopefully slightly less socially distanced Paul Foot Awards. Until then, the magazine is available for very reasonable subscription rates, as is our producer for this episode, Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Goodbye.